Except for the absence of OpenMedia, and then there are one or two that I'm not so sure of on the ANC list. We could always, of course, interview them and then decide. But the one thing I feel strongly about is Gumede number 17.
Yes, please recall them. Please remember them. Enjoy that shortlist for purposes of teaching them. So we're choosing a person for the commission at this point.
Thank you, Chair. I'm in agreement with a number of the proposals made by the Honourable Dean Smuts of the DA and some of what the ANC will notice that they did coincide. So our suggestion would be Mr. Advocate Ralph Carney, which is HRC 40, Amir, which is 18, which we agree with. Those two are, by most of us, I think we can almost agree on those two. I would like us to look at Dr. Gumede. I think that there's merit in his candidateship. And Dr. Did we all agree with Jitan? Yeah. So that's. Yeah, so I think that's there's broad agreement on that. I did propose Pastor Moss and Clow, but I think in view of the suggestion that where there's one or more parties that have suggested we should forego one or two, so I'm prepared to forego that reluctantly, but to get consensus. So there's a broad consensus as we're moving forward, Chair. Thank you. Amira.
Amira.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Also, that's number 18, HRC 18.
Yes.
Yeah, I just want to support my colleague on the issue of Ms. Sotso. She really doesn't appear to have the relevant experience at all for this position, and I would rather not see her shortlisted. But otherwise, I'm happy with other suggestions.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, number 17, which is Gumede, would be my third candidate. The first one would be number 28, Professor Jaichand, and 51, Mr. Kutswana. And then the third one is 17. 17.
Mm.
Sorry. So you've just chosen three. Okay. Mm. Demanding.
Of which two we've already agreed on.
Probably most reasonable.
Very, very reasonable.
That's very
Now, the simple way out is to say let's have all seven. Alternatively, we can argue Gumede in more depth and see whether there's someone who could give way to him.
Can I say whether we can make way forward? If the ANC says we are not pushing for which are 3 number 10.
Which
one
that?
10.
Yeah.
It's actually 10. And then Kumete. In the place we are supporting Kumete.
Give me the list, please, Mr. Sivanyoni.
One of the other books. One.
I think it's this one is the K.
It's
HRC 51. Dr. W. Bumente.
Which is the application fee, am I correct?
HRC 17, correct?
Number 3, which is Amir Mira.
It's Amir Mira.
HRC 18.
HRC 28.
Yes. Professor, I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And then followed by Advocate MJ Rabi Fatane.
Advocate MJ Rabi Fatane.
HRC 40. And then NP Kejane, HRC 66.
Just one HRC 66.
Yes.
Honorable members, this is a full-time position.
Yeah.
I'm raising this in that context. Professor J. Chan holds a very senior position at Pitt.
Mm.
Is he going to be leading that
for
the commission?
That's
awesome. I'm just wondering, you know, aloud, and does it make sense? School time.
Did it?
All right. Okay, we'll look for last. Ms. Adams?
Chairperson, number 66.
Yes?
There was no acceptance letter in that CV, unless with my power, it just wasn't part of it.
Okay.
What? Johnny, there was no acceptance letter.
She had promised him he would get it today.
So up until now there's
no acceptance letter.
There's 76 nominations, and I assume that in that huge number, her acceptance letter was, I don't know. I didn't think for a moment that she hadn't in fact sent it. Is that a problem for you, Ms. Adams?
I just think that one rule should apply for all of them. And that was one of the problems that I've raised at the beginning. What do we do with CVs that doesn't have any acceptance letters? And we have said we're not going to accept them. Because there was a proposal that those candidates should be contacted. And again, I've raised a concern about that. Now, I find it strange that Vanani had to contact this person just to get the acceptance letter, and we are sitting here, we were supposed to do it this morning. Maybe because you knew I might be a few minutes late, you decided not to do it this morning. But now it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon and Bonani is running out to go and get an acceptance letter, and I just think it's unacceptable. In any event, we've got names that we have agreed on from the different political parties. There's one position. I don't see why we should now still run around for one acceptance letter. Why can't we just interview those ones that we have agreed on?
Okay. Amazing with that. I think that's fair.
But Bonani appears to have invited her to send acceptance on the basis of some misunderstanding she has sent him a trick certificate. We don't, are we not now creating new problems if we have asked for a letter? She's clearly indicating that she will accept. So are we not creating other problems, administrative problems, if we now exclude her? Can Bonani establish contact and find out before the proffer attends if we take an actual vote?
Yeah. All right. By the way, I didn't know you were going to be late this morning. So you didn't send me your normal SMS.
Just
checking.
I think it's correct that we need complete clarity from Bonani when he actually asked. If we took a decision last time that they would be able to be contacted, then we need to know when he contacted her and when she responded with what. And if it was made quite clear in an email that we want the letter of acceptance and she sends a matric certificate, then I'm not sure she should be interviewed in any way. If it was very clear in an email, like for example, that we wanted a letter of acceptance and then she sent a matric certificate, then she probably doesn't qualify to be a commissioner anyway.
I think the advert asks for a letter of acceptance anyway. So that was up front from the very beginning. Perhaps Mr. Romano only realized late in the process that it wasn't amongst all the documents and then decided to call her. But I'd rather he answer that. I don't want to answer for his behalf. On his behalf. Chief Justice.
No, not quite that long. It's not pretty long. It does last.
Oh, that's the JSC. It's not the portfolio committee.
Yeah.
That's what I mean.
Yes.
Therefore, what I'm
So we ask Mr. Bassett to proceed. Yes.
That's what I mean.
Okay. Are we done with 42, Mr. Bassett?
Chair, yes. We got some drafting instructions from that person for the must also be included in the panel of appeal tribunal. Must make sure that it's not the same person that's served in previous disciplinary matters. I think those are some of the issues. I'm not too sure about the heading. I didn't really deal with it of clause 42. There's some questions there. Maybe I've left it open question marks. The contents of the clause does deal with appeal against conduct or decision and of the investigative committee and the disciplinary committee. Maybe we should replace the word decision with finding. We used the word finding elsewhere in the bill when we discussed last week, I think it was. We suggested that we use the word finding when we discussed clause 12 about the removal of a person from office. It's a finding of misconduct. So rather than use the word decision in the heading, maybe we should use finding.
What decision, what conduct?
There's a proposal that we insert the word the conduct of an investigating committee or disciplinary committee, because in terms of the provisions of clause 42, you can appeal against a complainant who is aggrieved by the manner in which an investigating conducted its investigation or the outcome of a disciplinary hearing. So I just raised the question whether we shouldn't include that concept in the heading, appeal against conduct or finding of investigating committee or disciplinary committee. That in as well, and sanction to include.
So dismiss the appeal against the conduct, finding, or sanction. Okay.
Why had investigating committee in square brackets? It depends on the committee's decision whether the appeal is also going to be against the investigating committee, but I think that's come out in the discussions that will be the case.
I don't think we really completely clarified what we wanted to do regarding the Ombudsman and whether the decision was taken not to proceed. And I think Dean's suggestion was probably the better one, because I did raise the issue of numbers. But could we not include maybe if the decision not to prosecute, then it can be appealed to the Ombudsman. And then it doesn't automatically all go on automatic review. And then we can somehow include that here.
Put that on hold for the moment until we make a decision about the Ombudsman. Yeah, then of clause 42, thank you, Chair. Clause 43, there were no suggestions for any amendment, but in the footnote, I think this also will be dependent on the outcome of the provisions on the Ombud. What role will the Ombud play? Because clause 43 says that Ombud may monitor the investigation of a complaint by an investigating committee and the conduct of a disciplinary committee during a disciplinary hearing. So the footnote merely says that this is dependent on the outcome of the deliberations of the portfolio committee.
Yeah.
Clause 44, a small technical amendment, and that relates to the definition of High Court that's been inserted in clause 1. We don't have to refer to the High Court having jurisdiction because it's taken care of in the definition. And the same applies to clause 45. The amendment there relates to the definition.
Okay. 46.
come to the chapter dealing with legal services ombudschap. And as I said right at the beginning, we were asked to build in an option to give the ombud more watchdog powers, recommendatory powers, rather than decision-making powers. I've got a loose document I'll hand out shortly where we built in this option. This is one of those provisions that I didn't get to when I handed the document out last week. But if we go straight to clause 46, that deals with the establishment of the office of ombud, and there's only one small technical question that we raise as drafters. The ombud, the bill read, may in consultation with the minister determine the seat of the office of the ombud. Question arises, surely the ombud must determine the seat, it shouldn't be discretionary, and that's for the committee's consideration. Okay. There were no proposals for clause 47, which deals with the objects of the ombud, but this might be subject to change again depending on the committee's outcome of deliberations on what the ombud must do. Then we come to the appointment and independence of the ombud. We were asked to prepare an option regarding the appointment, possibly where the Parliament or the National Assembly plays a role in the appointment of the ombud. So as the bill was introduced, that's the first, there were no proposals for that particular, for any particular amendment. And then for the committee's consideration, this is the option that we were asked to prepare where Parliament plays a role. The President must, subject to paragraph B and subject to subsection 2, and as soon as practicable after the commencement of this Act and whenever it becomes necessary thereafter, after consultation with the Council, appoint a legal services ombud. The President must appoint one of not more than five persons nominated by an ad hoc joint committee of Parliament established in terms of the joint rules of Parliament for that purpose, according to the following principles, as the legal services ombud: participation by the public in the nomination process and transparency and openness. That's just an example that we took from the CASA legislation. That is a proposal that's on the table. I tried to have a look at the joint rules of Parliament, and as far as I could make out, that is a possibility that may work for the committee's consideration. Question was raised whether it should be Parliament that is involved or whether it should be the National Assembly. I think it might be Parliament. One of the reasons why it might have to be Parliament, if we bear in mind that this is a Section 76 bill now and it's going through the whole process, but that's for the committee to decide.
And,
Yes.
And just a is that this ad hoc committee must send five names and the President gets to choose one?
Not more than five.
Yeah.
Can send one, can send two, but not more.
Yeah, than why didn't we think in terms of the ad hoc committee making the actual choice? I mean, the question then revolves around, all of these things revolve around the degree of independence of a functionary.
Yeah.
And an ombud, depending on what we make of this ombud, I would think it does have to be an independent person. Now, the public protector is a full-scale Chapter 9, so that's independent, and the vote of the National Assembly by 60% determines who the President has to appoint. This is an ombud. It's still supposed to be independent, certainly of the legal practice council, right? In this case, the independence is not so much of the executive, which I guess is the crisp point. On that argument, you could arguably say, all right, send up a list of names. But what really is the purpose of giving the President a discretion?
Yeah.
It is also not the post of the ombud for the legal services is not part of the executive. If the whole argument is that the legal profession is independent because of its relationship with the courts and the judges, then their ombud should also be his independent ombud for an independent profession. There's no conceivable role for the executive. It has nothing to do with the executive powers under the assorted sections numbered 80, 81, 82, 83, 84. So there's no executive dimension that I can see. And therefore, if this is the mechanism we use, I would think it would be that the ad hoc committee should send up simply the name chosen. If, however, we choose a retired judge, it becomes a different story. Or is it? Oh, you've put in the judge discharged even here.
I was about to ask you why.
All right.
Why?
Sorry, Chair.
No, I was about to ask Ms. Smith why the retired judges...
Why the what?
Well, you made an exception there.
Yeah, surely normally,
a retired judge, like any other judge, is by definition somebody completely independent. And if you are going to appoint a retired judge, how do we usually do it? It's usually appointed, it would be an appointment by... But a retired judge who must do service in another sphere now, who usually chooses the retired judges? Because once you're choosing a retired judge, there's no problem. He's an independent person anyway.
Is Parliament not allowed to choose a retired judge?
I'm not aware of any instance in which we do, which is not to say we can't do it for the first time. But how will this then work? Will the public... Don't forget, we've got the participation by the public in the nomination process, which is Section 59 of the Constitution, and which also is built into Section 193. Are we now going to invite the public to nominate retired judges? This is a key, this is unusual. It's a little unusual. Usually, and there must be so many instances where retired judges fulfill functions. I can't off the top of my head think what they are, and then who chooses them. Maybe the Chief Justice should
President in consultation with the Chief Justice.
Something like that, yeah.
President in consultation with the Chief Justice.
Appoints the... Yeah, that could work, huh? That could work very nicely. But I would say that the ad hoc joint committee model is separate from the retired judge as the candidate, right?
So let me understand you, Ms. Smith. We still proceed with the ad hoc.
As an option?
As an option.
Yes, I would say yes.
So there's a third option now of the President in consultation with the Chief Justice to appoint a retired judge.
I would think so, simply because we haven't made our minds up.
Just getting clarity. Okay. So that everyone who's listening in understands what we're saying.
Simple question.
Yes, Mrs. Shepherd.
Why is the President simply doesn't do it?
Huh?
For 19 months, for example.
Why,
sir? So what if the President simply doesn't do it?
What if he fails to do so?
I'm not being mischievous. It's two very real examples right now at the moment. And I'm not being mischievous. I'm serious. Then we need a deeming provision, maybe. Parliament will then choose and that we deem to be appointed.
But then can we choose a retired judge? There's hesitancy and discomfort about choosing a retired judge.
Yeah, think about why.
Well,
separation of powers, we're not interfering in powers. I don't know. But there must be some,
there has to be, unfortunately, there's just precedent for action not being taken when it should be taken. And we need to think about some way of avoiding that.
Best.
Chair, I don't have it wrong, but has a decision been made that it's going to be a retired judge?
The question, it arose, Mrs. Dean Smith's thinking through that the option of the ad hoc committee is there, okay? Together with public participation in the nominations process. Now, you've got the judge discharged from active service, that's a retired judge. And the question was, Well, can Parliament choose such a retired judge? And then it's going to say, well, perhaps the case of the interpretation of the Chief Justice should choose the retired judge. In that situation, Mr. Schaefer is saying, yes, well, he fails to do so. And we're without an ombud for 2 years.
I just remembered an example where a committee of parliament did sit in selection and where a retired judge, I think, had himself nominated. This was for the Equality Committee, which is that little thing that exists under the Equality Act. It's never got off the ground, and it, I don't know, the sort of functions. It's the one that we deployed Sheila to, I think, for the MP candidate. But there was a wonderful senior, very retired judge from Johannesburg who made himself available and submitted himself to interview by us. I remember it vividly because he kept on phoning me for about a year afterwards to ask when were the results going to be announced. But that is, it's a little unusual. The Equality Committee is a strange animal, and This here is serious stuff.
All right. One thing is, I mean, presumably somebody has to sign the notice of appointment. Now, that's maybe where the problem comes in the deeming provision. But perhaps maybe the department can also give it some thought as to how we could deal with a situation like this without having to go back to court every time to enforce the president's obligation.
I'm not sure that would be appropriate.
Chair, maybe what we should do then is to do that third option, because this option is really the appointment of a person, of a retired judge, is one of the options still on the table. And I think these provisions, introductory provisions, really are and at that, let us do a third option where, as has been discussed now.
But just look at the possibility of a situation where the president fails to appoint. What we can put in there to
avoid a long protracted book.
Yes, to avoid a long protracted wait.
Has any strong objections to the candidate, then we provide for a certain time period within which he can raise those objections or refuse to make the appointment or whatever, if that's possible. I don't know. But I mean,
are we talking about the retired judge?
Yeah, whichever. I mean, if he doesn't do it, then I don't know. Maybe the Chief Justice can just do it and leave it to take effect.
We'll have a look at something there. Chair, wouldn't these provisions would also probably be influenced by the eventual powers functions of the ombud, what type of ombud are we putting in place as well, and it would also, these
the removal provisions, which we will deal with shortly as well, clause removal from office would also depend on further discussions and deliberations on the powers and functions.
But in any event, in principle, I mean, I do think it's really important that the independence is maintained anyhow, no matter what their functions are, because, I mean, they are still dealing with the profession and there are still concerns regarding the independence of the profession, and I think they should be treated as equally as strictly as the Chapter 9, actually, as custodians of the independent profession.
Continue, Chair.
All right.
And that takes us to Clause 49. This is now the crux of the issue, powers and functions of the Ombud. Chair, I told the committee last time when I handed the document that you have now, I'd worked on, and I hadn't, you don't have it, and the latest additions to some of the clauses, and this is one of them. If I may hand out a document quickly, it really just has Clause 49 in there, and what has been done here, we were asked to have a look at an option in terms of which the Ombud plays a more watchdog role and has recommendatory powers, and that's what this is intended to give effect to.
Okay.
Some of the questions that were raised regarding the powers and functions of the Ombud as in the introduced bill was there are places in the introduced bill in the provisions which talk about recommendations, and questions were raised about what happens with the recommendations and the enforcement thereof. So these are the issues that hopefully we have addressed. Clause 49, the document that's just been distributed, there's an alternative to subclause 1 setting out the powers of the Ombud, and they are, a suggestion was made that we could possibly start by looking at the public protector's powers and functions, and that's what we did. We had a look at those, and we had a look at some of the powers and functions of the Human Rights Commission, and tried to limit them to a more watchdog type person or body. So maybe I should just read what the alternative suggestions are. In addition to the other powers and functions conferred on or assigned to him by this Act and for the purposes of achieving the objects referred to in Section 47, the Ombud is competent to investigate on his or her own initiative or on receipt of a complaint any alleged maladministration in the application of this Act, any alleged abuse or unjustifiable exercise of power or unfair or other improper conduct or undue delay in performing a function in terms of this Act, any alleged act or omission which results in unlawful or improper prejudice to any person which the Ombud considers may affect the integrity and independence of the legal profession and public perceptions in respect thereof. Some of this wording is taken from the original wording in Clause 49 as well. The Ombud, in terms of paragraph B, may, in carrying out the powers and functions contemplated in paragraph A, in his or her sole discretion, endeavour to resolve any dispute or rectify any act or omission by mediation, conciliation or negotiation, advising where necessary any person regarding appropriate remedies, or any other means that may be expedient in the circumstances. Paragraph C provides, at any time prior to, during, or after an investigation referred to in paragraph A, Ombud may, if he or she is of the opinion that the facts disclose the commission of an offence, bring the matter to the relevant prosecuting authority, or, if the Ombud deems it advisable, refer any matter which has a bearing on an investigation to the appropriate body or authority affected by it, or make an appropriate recommendation regarding the redress of the prejudice in question, or make any other recommendation that the ombud deems expedient to the affected body or authority. That's typically a public protector type watchdog power. Or the ombud, if the ombud is of the opinion that there is substance in any complaint made, and that the prejudice to the complainant or any other person adversely affected by the act or omission in question is substantial, and has the potential of affecting the integrity and independence of the legal profession and public perceptions in respect thereof, do anything necessary to enable proceedings to be taken to a competent court for the necessary relief, or direct or assist in directing a complaint to an appropriate forum. That is something out of the Human Rights Commission Act, or the Constitution, where the Human Rights Commission is dealt with. So we've tried to limit it to, as was suggested, to provisions that are already on the statute book, and where a watchdog type of function and powers are set out. And it also takes care of the enforcement of recommendations. The recommendations are simply made to the relevant body or authority. And then there are also provisions. There weren't any other suggestions as far as this is concerned in terms of subclause 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But in 7, also borrowing from Public Protector and Human Rights Commission, ombud may, subject to paragraph B, in the manner he or she deems fit, make known to any person or body any report or finding, point of view or recommendation in respect of a matter investigated by him or her. The report or finding, point of view or recommendation in respect of an investigation by the ombud must, when he or she deems it fit, but as soon as possible, be made to the complainant and to any person or body implicated thereby. And any report, finding, point of view or recommendation in respect of investigation by the ombud must be open to the public, unless the ombud is of the opinion that exceptional circumstances require that the report, finding, point of view or recommendation be kept confidential. That's in addition to provisions in the bill as well, in terms of which, and that's clause 53, these reporting duties in clause 49 are in addition to the annual report that the ombud must submit to the minister and parliament. For the committee's consideration, as I say, these are more watchdog regulatory type of powers, and it might be here where the committee would like to hear the results of the research that has been undertaken in respect of legal ombuds elsewhere in the world. Thanks, Chair.
Just without taking a final position or without redress, I just think it's been beautifully done. And you know what I like about sub C, Roman 3? There is the helping hand that I'm looking for. The consumers of legal services must have the feeling that there's someone they can go to who's going to help them further. And that's what Roman 3 does. Even this, on this model, the ombud then doesn't review or set aside substitute decisions. He can do anything necessary to enable proceedings to be taken to a competent court for the necessary relief, and he will obviously be doing this with the complainant. So I think this is beautifully done without taking the point. And yes, I'd love to hear that.
Anybody else?
Chairperson, looking at clause 47, it says the objects of the ombud are to protect and promote the public interest in relation to the rendering of legal services. Is it possible, because our bill does not define legal services as being those services rendered by legal practitioners, it doesn't say that, in fact it doesn't define legal services, is it possible that the ombud could be approached on this subclause by legal services rendered by a parastatal or a local municipality? Is it possible that can happen? Because we don't define legal services as being those services rendered by legal practitioners in terms of this act.
It's smart question. Schaefer, are you giving an answer?
No, it was related to my question the other day as well, and I think we need to relook at whether we should be defining legal services, because, I mean, then paralegals, as they are currently standing, are going to be able to give legal services without regulation at all. And that was my point the other day. And I think it's, I mean, it can't be that anyone who's purporting to give legal services, or what they deem to be legal services, or what the public deems to be legal services, can go to the ombuds. And but at the same time, they aren't regulated by that.
Chairperson, put another way, is the intention not to restrict the Office of the Legal Ombud to
legal
practitioners?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that is.
Because if it is, then, in my humble opinion, we need to consider the definition of legal service.
Yeah,
in that kind of
yeah. Okay.
Yes, for purposes of the same.
But then it might exclude other people who are giving legal service.
Well, that's the intention.
Yeah,
they're giving legal advice, you know.
Other people
are
giving
bound to accept it.
Yeah, but you are holding yourself out to someone who knows what you're talking about.
Then you take that chance.
I don't know about that.
This Act regulates attorneys, advocates. Doesn't as regulate paralegals.
Yeah,
no. So
they might be able to escape from the mix to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Who's going slow? Okay, slow. Sorry.
Thank you, Chief. In previous versions of the bill, we had a definition for legal services, and it caused a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically, other than notary conveyancing and court work, it's very difficult to limit it because you don't want to sink the banks as legal advice centers who do wills and estates and things like that. It just snowballs.
Mm-hmm.
So what we perhaps could do is just tweak clause 47 a bit to say protect and promote the public interest in relating to the rendering of legal services by legal practitioners,
yeah.
Or refer to the legal profession here also, it might be less complicated.
Yeah. Okay, Mr.
Best. On the other hand, I'm just thinking aloud, playing devil's advocate, maybe wouldn't it be good for the ombud to go wider, because the ombud is there to advise and to make recommendations and do investigations and report on the legal profession. And if things are going wrong and different categories of people are giving legal services, that shouldn't the legal ombud be coming with recommendations to say this is a trend that we've got to be on the lookout for? But I think the bill is really intended for legal practitioners, yes.
Once things start to modernize and liberalize, I read that remarkable paper about the latest developments in England and Wales. I mean, the whole field is going to become unrecognizable. I'm not sure who that paper came from. Was it and so, I mean, this bill is really, it's just a beginning. It is in many ways very mild. And things are going to change. We're going to do these little tiny incremental changes, like allowing the minister to look at multidisciplinary practices. Once that takes off,
it snowballs.
It snowballs. The landscape will become unrecognizable. And so,
yeah.
And so there is, I mean, there is that merit in what Advocate Bassett is saying, that the ombud could start picking up trends and feed into. It would be your own thinking. It would be the department's thinking on the next steps that will follow. So there is that virtue. I mean, I don't therefore reject the idea, although we are, maybe we should keep it tight and neat because we are doing the very first modest changes. And so the other side of the argument is to say this ombud at this point only looks at the advocates and attorneys professionals. It's probably neater and simpler. And when the landscape starts transforming, then this act will have to be amended.
I agree with that, but also I don't see how, you know, if we are passing a bill that regulates the profession, then I don't see how we can now suddenly bring other people in with the ombuds, because the ombuds really there to oversee the regulator. So I don't see how the ombud can suddenly step in at that point.
All right, so where are we? Flagging it?
Very fine new proposal to make a difference.
Very good.
And we need to decide at some point.
It's very obvious from another piece of legislation.
Well, notwithstanding that.
No, you have to do it.
And find it only for this.
Would that some of your colleagues and others?
Okay. And then maybe this would be an appropriate time to listen to the outcome of the research that's been done. I don't know whether you want to take
okay.
that now.
Honourable members, do you want to hear that? Okay.
Thank you, Chief. First, South African, we have the Financial Advisory and Intermediate Services Act that provides for an ombud for financial service providers. The objective of this ombud is to consider and dispose of complaints by clients against financial service providers in a procedurally fair, economical, informal and expeditious manner, and by reference to what is equitable in all the circumstances. We have a Tax Administration Act, a tax ombud. A mandate of the tax ombud is to review and address any complaint by a taxpayer regarding a service matter or a procedural or administrative matter. The Military Ombud Act provides for an office of a military ombud. It's to investigate and ensure that complaints are resolved in a fair, economic and expeditious manner. The Ombudsman for Banking Services is non-statutory. It's by underscribed by the banking industry voluntarily, and any bank customer who has a complaint against his or her bank may approach the Ombudsman. The service is free and only banks that are members are bound. Of more assistance probably is the other countries. One is Scotland. The Scotland Ombud investigates complaints about the way a professional organisation has dealt with a complaint about the solicitor or advocate's conduct. And then quoting from their document, the SLCC cannot investigate your original complaint. We cannot act as an appeal of professional organizations' decision, nor can we overturn or alter the decision. And then in Canada, they have a complaints resolution commissioner similar to an ombudsman, and it's also basically referral, let me just read here. In cases where a complaint against a lawyer or paralegal has been closed and you are unsatisfied with the results, you can apply for a review, and the commissioner will review the file to ensure that the complaint was handled appropriately and the results were reasonable. Then, let me just see. What we cannot do, investigate complaints about fees. Sorry, I will just have to look that up further. They provide alternative dispute resolution, and the clients that do not require a regulatory response. So it seems that they do regulate, give a response. Yeah.
The response is, and what do they then do, the alternative disputes themselves? Do they do they then basically mediate?
Yes.
And they change the recommendations, they could.
Yes. Unlike a typical ombudsman, the Law Society's Compulsory Resolution Commission has the authority to provide alternative dispute resolution for issues. Yeah.
And just going back to Scotland, who is Scotland part to the law? They don't go to the substance of that.
They will decide whether the professional organisation has given each complaint proper attention, if it has taken appropriate action on the basis of a fair and thorough examination of all the evidence, and if it has acted reasonably, impartially and effectively. It's basically review. Yeah. However, we will normally not intervene if a conduct complaint is still being investigated. So there is, the person must. And we cannot overturn or alter the decision by the professional organisation. And then England and Wales also has a procedure. A complainant must first complain to the lawyer and give him 8 weeks to respond, and thereafter 8 weeks. And the complainant can then approach the legal ombudsman, and then the legal ombudsman does a whole process. A discipline process.
After 8 weeks.
But a full discipline process.
Yes, and makes binding, it's a lot of rules, binding determination, including apologize, pay compensation of a specified amount for lost suffered interest. There's a whole range of sanctions.
If you say including compensation of a specified amount, are they predetermined amounts for certain offences, or are they able to determine compensation on an individual basis?
Sorry, I don't know that. I will have to investigate.
I'm sure there's stuff in proceedings in the
I think there was a bit of duplication. I think the researchers have also done some.
No harm done. All right.
Brings us then to the end of clause 49.
Okay. Remuneration, clause 50.
Definition of high court, which we've dealt with. And then in terms, this deals with remuneration and other terms and conditions of employment of the ombud. In terms of sub-clause 4, that ombud, in terms of the bill originally introduced, holds office for the period determined by the President at the time of appointment. The committee, as far as I recall, suggested a specific period so that there is clarity on the issue, without giving any periods that one could consider. What we've put in here is the period of office that the public protector holds. The public protector only holds office for one period of 7 years, but if you want, it could be extended, as we've suggested, as an option in terms of this clause. So the ombud holds office for a period of 7 years, but may serve for one further term of 7 years. Yes.
Mr. Bassett, can I take you to sub 2? It's pretty clear that we're pegging the salary of the ombud at that of the High Court judge. and hence we say may not be less. But effectively what this means is that it could be more. Because we found now that there's a certain individual now in the same salary as Supreme Court of Appeal judge. When originally it was our intention that that office should have the remuneration of a High Court judge, no more. So please look at that. Okay? I'm not blaming anyone, I blame myself because I'm also a member of Parliament. When these things are decided, I press the yes button. But we need to be sure that this also doesn't fall through the cracks and we find the Ombud is earning the same salary as the Chief Justice or some such person. Ms. Smuts.
A different question that occurred in the financial sector, I think. A different question. A while ago, a judge was appointed to lead Sajay, and everything came to a standstill because he insisted that he ought to be paid a salary, in addition, of course, to the salary for life. So what is the, and in the end we lost him, and the Chief Justice, over and above all the other many burdens that he carries, and the Deputy Chief Justice had to keep the show going at Sajay. But so what is the situation? I mean, the answer in that case was no, the salary for life covers it. Do we, in situations like these, determine salaries over and above? If our appointee is a retired judge, are we able to offer a further salary?
Yes, this provision as it is here doesn't take into consideration if the appointee is a judge. That's still one of the issues that's flagged. If it's going to be if that is one of the options, then this is going to have to be reconsidered as well. In terms of the Judges Remuneration Act 2001, a judge who's discharged from active service and if he or she's asked to do any other service, they can get additional remuneration. I'll have to get the provisions out, but that's determined for any additional service that is determined. I can't remember, but there is provision for an add-on, and the provisions are pretty tight there. You've got to go through a special procedure and get permission from, and I can't remember who the functionary is. It might be, no, I don't want to say things that I'm not aware of, but there is. But that additional service, there must be approval for it, and there is a determination over and above what they get for life.
I'm quite pleased, Chair, to hear that, because, I mean, a job on the scale of this Ombuds office for something like 5, 6, 7 years is asking too much of a retired judge to do that as a retirement job while earning his primary salary. I mean, I think in the end we're going to lose out if we don't pay people extra for these functions. It needn't be a full extra salary, but so I'm pleased to hear there is a possibility.
So what is it we're saying? Is it that the retired judge could earn more than
the
salary of a High Court judge?
Mm-hmm. No, it's a slightly different point.
It's just whether over and above the salary for life, they may be paid for jobs, extra jobs that they are asked to take on, that sort of thing. I mean, I suppose the implication is that you could end up getting...
Well, let me ask you this way. What will be the remuneration of the Ombud?
Depends who it is.
If it's High Court, a retired judge.
Depending on
what it is.
Double?
No, it's
not
a number.
No, why?
Well, it will depend what that provision that Advocate Bassett has just described says.
Yeah.
Mrs. Schaefer?
I didn't get the impression that it would necessarily be double.
Yeah, well, I do think we need clarity on that, and I've actually forgotten about that Sajay issue. It was a major issue, and it was quite embarrassing, actually. I mean, for 2 years, the Sajay sat without a head. And
I see the merit of judges saying, well, I get a salary for life and I'm retired and I can only be called on to do work every now and then. So I don't think it's quite the same as saying now being employed for 7 years full time.
I agree.
So I do see merit in that if other judges are not being called upon to do that to the exact extent of service and are still getting paid the salary, then I can see merit in saying that they should get more. But
yeah.
I do think it needs to be clarified up front what it's going
to
be.
It's not like asking someone to run a commission with more than over the card now. Putting
someone
in
service for 7 years, then what is
that?
Huge.
So
I would
not be opposed to
as
odd
as the rule.
At the meeting, I
was
about
the
names
now,
so we don't have
them on the set. Yeah, I know that there were no comments on this particular clause in the first round, but I do recall, is this benchmarking type of provision something that we should reconsider? If the functionary is not going to be a judge, a retired judge, should we be putting a provision like this, or couldn't we do it as other statutory appointees? It's determined by the president or in consultation with the Minister of Finance. This benchmarking type provision, I understand, has been problematic.
And just on that point, I mean, it might be worthwhile doing, because if you get somebody else, I mean, you could quite easily get a retired person from another profession who's retired early perhaps, and they're getting a full pension, and then they would be taking on the additional job. So in a way, it does make sense maybe to consider that. But the judge would then still have to give permission anyway to do extra work in any case. And that actually might create another obstacle. I mean, how do we do all that? What happens if they don't get the permission? But I don't suppose that's too likely if they aren't full-time service. But I think maybe we should look at delinking it, because, I mean, it could quite theoretically, quite potentially be the case that you get somebody, maybe a retired business person who's taken early retirement 55 or something like that, and applies for this position and gets it, and then they're still in the same position as the judge from a pension point of view.
What happens to the correctional
services, the inspector, judge inspector? That's a retired judge, isn't it? Or is it an active judge?
That's an active judge.
And the one on the interception and monitoring
Vika.
As well, Vika.
Retired judges.
So they would, I mean, those are quite substantive jobs as well, and I don't think they get paid extra. But the situation of retired judges sitting on arbitrations and mediations, they get paid for that.
They get
half the pay. It's not an easy decision at the end of the day, but I think by saying this, one's almost setting a benchmark for what one should pay, but whether it's retired judges salary scale. But the essence, are we considering not paying them another salary? So you get two salaries, you get your retired judges, and
that's
if you are,
that's
what
can't
be.
Said.
No, not a full set of salary.
Or an add-on or something.
It can be, because other judges are sitting there not doing
anything for that full-time pension. So why should somebody else do a full-time work for 7 years and not get any extra?
That's right.
In any case, but there was another point. Mr. Chair, should we not look at perhaps making this fall under the new legislation that we're going to be doing for Chapter 9 and so on, making it fall under the Independent Remuneration Commission?
Yeah. The next time I speak to Deputy Minister, I'm going to have to raise that.
Yeah.
You see, Mr. Bassett, Sub 1 says the President determines in consultation or after consultation, and then we go on to set down what the regulation should be. So isn't that also problematic? Why do we say the President determines the regulation, and then in Sub 2 set down what the...
Yes, it says the President subject to subsections
2 and 3,
so it may not be, I think they have a limit in mind, so the President still has some sort of discretion but within which to work.
So theoretically, in terms of this, the retired judge could have his salary for life and then an additional for the 7-year period. what I was trying to understand. What are we saying here?
The possibility of a judge being a retired judge being thought of as an ombud has an impact on this type of provision. I'm just trying then to be able to get into the Judges Remuneration Act now. I've got into the Judges Remuneration and Conditions of Employment Act 2001. Active, there's a definition of active service. That's a judge who's in active service, so it's before he retires or gets discharged from active service. Then there's a definition of service. Service means service as a judge of the Supreme Court of Appeal or a high court in the same or higher office held by the judge concerned on discharge from active service, or with the approval of the judge concerned, service in a lower court. It also means service as a chairperson or a member of a commission as contemplated in the Commissions Act, or C, service as a chairperson or a member of a body or institution established by and in law, and that's what we're talking about here, or service, any other service which a minister may request him or her to perform. And then there's a provision later on dealing with
in calculating the costing for the office of the ombud, I'm aware that the salary is paid at that at which the High Court judge is paid. So it becomes much easier when we take out the fact that, well, let's say the incumbent is not going to be a retired judge. You have to pay it, and it's paid. There's provision, it could be an advocate attorney in terms of those provisions, and in doing the costing exercise, we picked it at the cost of a High Court judge. So the only issue that is then being considered is whether a retired judge should be getting this extra salary, and that's subject to the terms and conditions, and it's an academic point, and the fact is the ombud might not be the retired judge, but for the purposes of informing the committee in the costing, which will be done, we'll provide it. But that's where it's pegged at.
Mr. Sibagnoni and then Mrs. Schaefer.
Is the living provision that a person who's not a retired judge is maybe considered as an ombud? I'm asking because I'm just speaking quickly. To say retired judge is somebody who must be quite old, and he's going to be there for 7 years. And then you say, another 7 years, 14 years after having retired, you must be.
Yeah.
Theoretically, it's possible.
Yeah, it's possible. That would work simple, then. Thank you for pointing. But then just means, look, if you can go from 70 to 75,
mm. Which means
you would take one, we would take Kate, or somebody who retired at 70 and give them a
1 cent. Or Yvonne McCaw.
Kate or
Yvonne
would be
perfect. But then you wouldn't want them to have 1 cent.
Sure.
You wouldn't necessarily want to limit them to one term.
Yeah.
That's why we should have the ability to, but not necessarily have to. I just wanted, I actually bumped into Kate the other day, shopping in a very ordinary way. I just wanted to, I mean, on this thing, it's fine to say, if we want to say, that a salary will be pegged at the level of a judge. But if I were a judge and I was doing that extra work, then I would expect that to be paid to me, in addition to my retirement benefit. Now we're not going to, I mean, we aren't going to quiz other people about what they're getting if they've retired.
Mm.
We're not going to say, are you getting a retirement, you know, are you getting a pension from your previous employment? And if so, why should we pay you X amount of money?
They may not be retired.
But they might.
There may be an advocate who's...
No, but they might. The point is we don't ask them. So why are judges being prejudiced, actually?
Okay. Don't take it.
I still think it should fall under the denomination.
Yes. We need to examine that.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean then that what is in clause 50 falls away? Or do we leave what's in clause 50?
Everything depends on making our minds up about the files and funds. Everything. Well, it depends on what we decide. If we
agree that it should fall under the remuneration committee, then it would. If we don't, if we agree that it should be pegged at the level of a judge, then I suppose then it's also not really necessary, although there may be other conditions that might have to be included.
That will, that we're talking about the remuneration, that's at the moment, and there's nothing stopping us from, it only deals with chapter 9s, and that
yes,
was,
yeah,
yeah.
All right, is there any more discussion on this? None.
Can I just sort of get a recap on what we must
yes.
do here, to build in an option where there's no benchmarking?
Well, I think it sounds fine as it is. It's just that we don't want it, I don't know, I hear what Mr. Dyer says, may not be less. And the salary of a judge of the High Court, but not more either in this time. Or are we thinking of making it more? No. Then we must say that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it gets out of hand.
Yeah, well, that's also fine.
If we do that, then we don't have to worry about the other bills. In any case, we can just say it will be the same.
Whenever the judges increases, this person is also.
Yeah, but then of course you would, does that include judges' benefits as well? Because then they might argue, well, the package includes all these other cars or whatever else they get.
That's what you have to worry about.
They might say, well, that's equivalent to this amount of money. So,
and I think we do need to check that the Act doesn't preclude this being paid, or that there isn't a limitation on what can be paid to judges. Retired.
Okay,
Chair, subclause 1 provides for the allowances and other terms of conditions of service and service benefits. So that would relate to the cars and all the extras.
Then the word remuneration must come out of subclause 1.
I think so,
no?
Chair, because it's still within that, it gives that discretion for the President to work within a range, unless the committee feels.
No, that's fine. No, that's fine. That's fine as long as...
I think maybe we're just quite certain that remuneration means only that fixed part of the salary then, because if there's any room for... Is remuneration only the actual... whatever they call it? I mean, I don't know.
The remuneration is
actual. Yeah. But you refer to section 2.1.
Yeah.
The
2.1 of the Judges Remuneration Act.
Yeah.
It probably is everything.
Yeah.
Let's just check on that. And as amended, because that reference to 2.1 would mean as amended every year, because the amendments would be done in terms of 2.1 as increased, which is not unreasonable. But I just think we need to check whether the reference to section 2.1 probably refers to salary and benefits.
All right.
2.1A.
And such allowances or benefits as determined by the President from time to time by notice in the Gazette.
Why would that be unreasonable to do that? Paying it at a judge plus.
You're not saying it isn't theory, but you're saying it needs to be taken into account.
Yeah.
You need to know what the remuneration is.
That sounds okay.
It would seem as if the President determines the extra additional service for judges who are discharged from active service. The additional, if a judge does any additional service after discharge, after discharge from active service, that would seem so. I would like to go back and but just a quick glance, that's what it seems to be.
All right, can we move off this item? Mr. Romano?
Yes, what is the proficient proctor?
Yes. Have you spoken to Mr. Tejan? Please put your mic on.
It's here, it's here, that's what it is.
Where?
Have you got that in writing?
Yes.
Where?
She just said it a few minutes ago.
Chairperson, when was she contacted?
I've been having problems contacting him directly. Yes, I already said the phone number 24. I called the person who met it in last week. And then I promised to send back me. He didn't do it. Yesterday I reminded him. Instead of sending me the acceptance, he forwarded me the academic. Things are going to test that his case is on diploma for the change. So, just after Friday today, I went back to the office just to check if that acceptance was part of the degree for England and Glasgow. And then I called her and she said it.
Your request last week, you had refreshed it.
Yeah.
It says quite clearly you were looking for acceptance of nomination. Was it in written form?
No, I called the person, but the thing was fixed to me, so I couldn't have got to them. So I called the person who nominated, and then I couldn't get all the person.
That's possible.
So then the person who nominated said that he was going to call there. And I think he called me. They said that they don't take me. And then the document that I received, I don't know, but when I look at the date, it was done sometime in April. Just a while ago, the first week, and I would have been done. Maybe it was in the second week.
Was it
from a 15-year
basis?
Yeah.
Mr. Schwartz, I think so. We need to set a principle or a rule in the future, because I think that maybe when we receive CVs in future, we should, at that point, there are documents missing, we've got to consider, do we ask for those documents? We made it very clear in our advert what we need. So I think in this case we can, because it was we gave that opportunity, we should condone that, but I think we need to set a principled decision for future how we deal with it. We either say if your documents are not complete, you will not be considered, or we send a letter to, once we've received the letter, the CVs, and say if you don't forward your documents within 7 days, your application will not be considered. There are two ways of doing it, so that we establish some form of rule. I'm not upset with what has happened here really, but I think we just need to set a principle for how we deal with it in the future.
Ms. Schwartz,
Yes, I think that is correct, and we should also be absolutely firm about deadlines. This is a committee that works in good faith and well, but the principles are important because there are other committees which follow comparable procedures where there is big political game playing going on all the time. So you have to set your rules, you stick by them, you don't sneak in CVs late.
Mm.
But there's a reason, a particular reason why I think that we must condone this, and that is that I'm not sure that the administration was perfect on our committee's side. I remind you again that the CV and nomination of Punita Naidu was stapled to number 43. It had no number whatsoever. I happened to find her at the end of whoever number 43 was. I admire Punita Naidu, and I'm the person who wanted to have her considered for the shortlisting. And so things can go wrong on the committee's administrative side, and that's why you have to, for all we know, staple acceptance was somewhere, got stapled in somewhere. So I think we have to accept it, I condone it, but we likewise should be strict on the rules.
Anybody else?
Full bench condemnation. I concur.
I agree with the principle, but the point is, if we have principles and the administration still isn't right, it doesn't help. Because, you know, we might say, well, it wasn't here, but actually it was here. Now, I mean, on the Magistrates Commission, we have actually been incredibly strict. In the appointments and shortlisting process now, if the documents aren't there, they don't get taken, and that's it. And the quality of the applications has improved a lot, I can promise. Chairperson, I asked myself the question, if I didn't raise this issue, when would we have received this explanation? Because the name was number 66, it was one of the names that was raised last week. I would have assumed that the first thing that we do is we get that acceptance letter. Now we are deciding to accept the CV, but we haven't even seen this acceptance letter. We don't even know whether it's signed. We are told it's an email, but so we just accept it on good faith and we okay it, and I'm very uncomfortable with it, because with all the CVs, and we received quite a lot, there were more than one that didn't have an acceptance letter or a nomination letter, and it was on that basis that I have excluded those candidates. Luckily, those ones, or unluckily, I don't know, they were not part of the other political parties. But the fact is, we have agreed, no acceptance letter, no nomination letter. If you do not meet the requirements, you automatically fall out. Now, this person comes out now, and we just have to accept it. I'm very uncomfortable, and I feel that we should not accept this person.
Before I hear you, Mr. Roman, Mr. Simonioni, did you want to
add something? On my side, also, I would say this person having been contacted to say please submit, I think it raises an expectation, and then at this stage it will be too late to say we are not accepting the, we're not accepting the acceptance letter. I think I would support the view that we lean towards accepting this one.
Mr.
Actually, I just want to say that after the provisional list that we agreed to last week, I checked in the CV just to make sure that all the papers were in order. So this one didn't have that. Then I tried to call her and I couldn't get her. But then I called the person who nominated her just to say that there was a document missing, it should be forwarded to. The agreement was that it should be sent, I think it was yesterday by 10 o'clock, which didn't say, I didn't get it. Then I called again later yesterday to say that before 10 o'clock, that they were coming to it. I must send it. And then there was a document sent to my email while I was there in this meeting. When I opened it, it had just a certificate on from there. I went back to the office just to make sure that, because like, I mean, I was opening it from the iPad, so maybe I was So I went back to check only to find that the acceptance was not there. So when I called her to find out as to why she sent me the city's case and not the acceptance, she thought maybe everything had been signed by the person who nominated her. And then she undertook to personally send it to me, which she did some few minutes ago.
No, you couldn't get hold of her.
No.
Was her phone not working?
No.
Not at all?
No, it was.
So she's also given us a number that doesn't work?
The number does work. You know, I even tried to call one of the persons that she listed as a reference so that I could get hold of her.
No, but I mean her own telephone number that she gave us in this application wasn't working.
I'm not saying that the telephone number she gave doesn't work. Sometimes it happens, I don't know, maybe you know, network errors, you try to call a number, you don't get through, and then I tried again until I could get on the computer.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Spagnoli is correct in saying that an expectation has now been created, and I think that this meeting is in public and it will be known that she was shortlisted. But perhaps what we could do is make sure that we ask her that in the interview and ask her to give an explanation as to why she didn't send and what happened with the message and so on.
Yeah.
Right.
I do tend to share Ms. Adams' discomfort. All right. So, can we move on to clause 51, Mr. Bassett?
Clause 51, you see my footnote there says there weren't any specific proposals for amendment, but I think the provisions there are going to have to be, they will be determined again by
chronologic. Who determines the misconduct? It says the president may remove on account of misconduct.
He does.
Really?
No.
Who does?
It will follow what we decide on the appointment process. And then that must be reflected here. So obviously this is, the removal from office is a crucial part of security of tenure for an independent process. So that appointment process must, and then we'll have to add in a lot here, more about what grounds, who, under what provisions, and to ensure security of tenure.
That's correct. I think these provisions, with all due respect, are pretty inadequate, and we need to take into account what the eventual decision is. May I just point out to committee members that in terms of section 51(3), whenever the ombud is not available, the president may, subject to this chapter, appoint a person as an acting to exercise the powers and perform the functions. And then we're on the subject now, so nobody said anything about it. Maybe I should just point it out. And in terms of clause 4, the president must determine the remuneration, allowances, and other terms and conditions of service and service benefits of the acting ombud after consultation with the minister and the minister of finance. Nobody said anything, but we're on that subject now.
Well, whenever the ombud is for any reason unable to exercise his powers or functions, what happens?
You see another one. We'll deal with that another day, but the president doesn't get to put in an act.
No, I understand that.
Yeah.
Fine. You've made that very clear.
You've made your point.
So what happens when the ombud is for any reason unable to exercise or perform his powers? That's what we have to answer, okay?
One second.
Mr. Dyer?
In the instance of illness, accident,
stroke.
Yes.
Now move on to 52. Yes, that deals with staff finances and accountability. And I have a note here. We were asked when we discussed this last that we must go and have a look at the Sadger Act because the provisions there we might find pretty useful. Those provisions of the Sadger Act were taken into consideration when this was drafted. I just want to report back to on that. In terms of subclause 2, 52.2, this deals with the period of appointment of the director in the office of the legal ombud, and the committee requested us to put in an option in terms of which there are the boundaries are set. And what is being suggested is the Ombud must appoint a director for an agreed term not exceeding 5 years, which may be renewed for one additional term not exceeding 5 years. And then if that is...
Can I just ask why we want him 5 years here in the term of office of the Ombud of 7? Would it not make sense to think the two, well, suppose we're not guaranteed that that same person will stay necessarily, but why was 5 years sort of?
Seems to make sense to make it the same as the Ombud, Mr. Bassett. Yeah, he's appointing the director, so.
Over and over again, the desirability of continuity, and especially with things like the chaplains and other independent incumbents who necessarily circulate or come and go. And it therefore it becomes very useful if you have CEOs and staff who provide the continuity.
Yeah, I mean, going against my own argument in a way, I mean, I suppose if somebody leaves after the current ombuds there for 3 years and then they get appointed for 7, there will be an overlap in any case. So but I just wondered why was 5 thought of?
I think, you know, we're also looking at the legal aid bill at the moment in the department, and there's a provision there for the CEO to be 5 years. So it is arbitrary, but we did sort of benchmark it on what else we are doing, and then also the continuity aspect.
Why must the director have a circumscribed term?
If he's good at his job, why can't he stay on?
Think about it.
He's not an office bearer, administrator.
Does the CEO of the public protector stay on for a...
No, they are
ineffective. As I say, we are busy with a similar exercise in the legal aid act. This is your CEO type of person, and I think... isn't it?
Only for parliamentarians and high-profile incumbents of, you know, great office who suffer this detriment of... having to recycle every 5 years or 7 years.
Chair, as Lawrence said, with research for the legal aid bill, it seems as if CEOs are usually they have fixed terms. It's general in a lot of
we have got information, it's just not on our fingertips, and we can go now.
If I recall, the municipalities and municipal manager, and I think all the EDs also have 5-year contracts, I think.
The CEO of the public protector, is his term prescribed? Can anyone remember?
No, I'm sure they're not.
But the previous one, he actually applied for this.
The position.
And then you get it and you resign.
I was going to say something more,
Mr.
Was
that
the
human rights commission?
Human rights.
I wonder if the CEO is even in the Public Protector Act.
So how does he or she get appointed? Alright, don't worry. We're talking about a director here. Yeah. I don't know whether the director is the same as the CEO anyway. Director's nicer than the CEO? Okay. Don't go there.
Yes,
he's being examined by the optometrist, and he can't afford to have his phone going off every so often.
All right. So, Chair, as I say, most of these provisions are really based on a lot of what was in we were asked in clause 5, Minister must, after consultation with the Minister of Finance, determine the remuneration allowance and staff benefits of the members of staff. We were asked to include the staff establishment structure, so that is also subjected to the consultation process with the Minister of Finance.
Ms. Benson, can I ask you, it speaks about the appointment of staff here. Is staff public servants?
No, they won't be public servants, Chair. That would have otherwise said subject to the laws governing public service. And this is pretty standard. In the work that we're doing with legal aid has pretty much similar. So these are certainly not public servants.
This is a different branch of state by extension.
And that's why their remuneration must be determined by the Minister in conjunction with the Minister of Finance.
Okay. Then my next question is staff complaints. Taken back will be dealt with when that bridge is crossed.
Yeah, but all of these institutions by now have their human resources department on
the causing that comes to us to do
on that note.
The thing is, we have very good intentions when we establish these offices. We, in fact, are quite starry-eyed. And,
it's a very unusual path.
Sometimes down the road, we realized, well... yes.
But you can't. You can't have directors general controlling the flow of finance to independent bodies. You can't have public servants whose first loyalty is to the executive branch of government running the independent institutions.
Yeah.
It's a contradiction in terms. You can't. And when people do want to get up to mischief, then the scope for mischief is immense, because there really are such things as ministries, government departments who gun for the independent regulators. And this is in a different context altogether, but I mean, this is a big buck scenario.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else under this clause? The DG of Justice will be the accounting officer, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The system.
So I'm just looking at the Public Sector Act, and I see that they allow for secondments.
Can't hear you.
They allow for secondments of staff.
No, but that's the old Act.
No, this is as an end.
What year? See, when we started...
2003, because it allowed for secondments.
Because when we started all these things, SECRA didn't even exist then, but the IDA and SECRA. And in order to start them up, staff were transferred from old departments of post and telegraph, if you remember there was such a thing.
Telecommunication.
Because they officially set up. The only existing telecom engineers in the country were set. They were the old experts from post and telegraph. So to start the thing up, you transfer the staff, and it's justifiable for that reason, but there's absolutely no argument for transferring staff to the public protector. I mean, I found it odd that so many of them are members of the Public Service Association, which shouldn't be that. Maybe there's some argument that this deals precisely with maladministration in the government sphere, but it's not immediately apparent to me what the argument would be.
All right. Anything else under this clause?
There's one more clause, and that ends the chapter. That's the annual report.
Let's do that.
I've made mention it at the beginning. The department must submit to the minister an annual report, and the minister must table the report in Parliament. There were no specific proposals.
Where's the minister?
Shameful.
Why must
you
go to the minister? Shouldn't it go straight to Parliament?
I have a question.
sometimes one ends up with a compromise thing where the report is sent to the minister for treatment in Parliament.
Who's going to make all the copies Parliament requires?
Who does it now?
The person tabling it.
Yes.
I think that, you know, it's also...
No. It's not the speaker. Sorry, Mr. Bassett. It's not the speaker. The rule is, if you are tabling any report in Parliament,
mm-hmm.
Parliament says, we want X number of reports, X number of copies.
Mm-hmm.
And until you bring those copies, they don't accept your tabling. Yes? So, if you're saying this office must table it directly, they will pay.
What happens with public protection? Is it issue?
No.
I think it also it goes through the minister.
Mm-hmm.
I think virtually the first note.
I don't think it does, no.
She doesn't table. Yes, she doesn't, Mr. Bassett. It's one of our rights that we are simply ignored. It's our fault. We said the office may determine how the reports are prophesied. That's how that came about. Big mistake.
Okay,
but
then
she'll pay for it. Yeah. Then she'll send Parliament one copy.
Anyway,
all right.
What about maybe an option saying that prepare and submit to the minister who shall immediately table?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. I'm trying to understand why would the minister not table?
Why would the president not appoint anything?
Chairperson, I was just wanting to know what costs are we talking about? I mean, is it running into millions? Because it's twice a year. It's only so many reports. What are we talking about?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure how many copies Parliament requires.
Six.
The number of MPs there are. For start. And then the media.
That's actually a way to mean much.
It's a lot. And a lot of these reports are glossy. So, you know, they choose to make them glossy, and that adds to the expense. And then after a while, they come to us and say, we're not being given enough money. That's what happens with that. I've seen it so many times now that I don't mind if you say it must be tabled directly, okay? As long as you understand the implications or the consequences of the event. Yeah, that's the next thing, because we were insisting at the ANC that she should table it, put it on Parliament's website.
Yeah.
How much could that cost?
Yeah.
And then let Parliament, you know, say to everyone, there it is.
There it is.
Yes. If you want to download it, so be it. Yes.
We've been requested to have a look at amendments to the Debt Collectors Act, and the Debt Collectors Council is asking us to make provision, specific provision for electronic tabling. Is that not, if it says it must be tabled in Parliament, would that not include electronic tabling, or how does Parliament react to something like that?
We initially liaise with Parliament's legal advice. I don't see that as being a problem. I see that as being a solution. Because really, if you come to table something in Parliament, they promptly say to you, well, there's an official here, says, I want X number of copies.
No, there's nothing
in the rules, as far as I can recall,
so
that says
electronic tabling solves that problem.
Yeah.
goes on Parliament's website, then everyone can access it.
What's the definition? Is there a definition of tabling the joint rules?
Well, I don't know. That's something that we need to be looked at. It's a very good idea.
Yes. Same, it's terribly expensive for them to do this.
All right. Shall we stop there?
Okay, on another matter, may I just raise quickly?
Yes.
What progress are we making with the public sector appointment to come and respond? Remember, we were going to change the date.
No. We have said no, not this Friday. Yes. We have a certain suspicion about the choice of Friday.
I thought we were waiting to get
our
date,
though.
Yes.
Chairperson, I thought that we were waiting for a response first, and then we would probably have... Yes, but we asked her for a response in writing first.
Mm-hmm.
In the letter.
But she has sent the letter, and she reminds us that she has already pointed by point dealt
with as it's done. She did that, but
I thought that we should respond.
No, we have to...